Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this week's podcast, we're going to be delving into the question we keep getting asked: how are we going to pay back the debt from the coronavirus pandemic? And to do so, we have the best possible guest, Stephanie Kelton. Stephanie is a professor, an author, an unofficial spokesperson for the Modern Monetary Theory Group. But bear in mind, this isn't investment advice. We can't guarantee sources from outside Bruendorfin, and tax legislation and allowances can change. Also, please remember that when investing your capital is at risk, investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. Now, we have previously on the podcast heard a somewhat critical review of modern monetary theory from Ian Lance at RWC, but this is the first time we have an advocate on delivering a radical but liberating theory about how to deal with the public finances going forward. So to hear that, keep listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Bruin podcast. We are really thrilled on this occasion to be joined by Stephanie Kelton, who I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of. Stephanie is a professor at Stony Brook University and a senior fellow at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the School of the New School of Social Research. But she's, I think, probably best known for her book, The Deficit Myth. And I think it's a really brilliant time to be talking to you today, Stephanie, because the global economy is hopefully in the process of reopening. And certainly we hear from our clients and from our listeners a lot of anxiety about what's going to happen with the huge amount of public expenditure that has been made in order to try and keep the economy going during these really difficult months. So, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense for a lot of listeners to think that when all of that additional borrowing has been incurred, it at some stage has to be paid back. But I mean, essentially, the premise of your book is that maybe that's the wrong way of looking at things. So, I mean, would you be able to just kind of lay out in at a very high level, you know, why that very logical kind of conclusion would perhaps be false?
Well, sure. So first, thank you for having me. It's nice to get an opportunity to talk through some of these things with you. Look, I think that basically where you want to begin is in recognizing that the debt that you and I incur when we borrow, the debts that are incurred by private business when they borrow, are fundamentally different from this thing that we call the debt when the federal government issues securities. Okay, so I think what we have is not any kind of fiscal problem. We don't have a deficit problem or a debt problem. We have a communications problem. We are using terms like borrowing and debt to describe what's happening to the currency issuer, the federal government's budget, and they're just simply inapplicable. We should not be using these terms because they just confuse things and they don't really reveal the nature of what's really happening, the nature of the mechanics of government finance. So you want to start, I think, by recognizing that a currency issuing government like the UK, like the US, like Japan, like Australia, many others, governments that issue a non-convertible, right? So we're not talking about fixed exchange rates. We're not talking about governments that pledge to convert their currency into something they could run out of, like gold or another country's currency. Talking about floating exchange rate, fiat currency, governments that spend their own unique currency into existence, never need to borrow their own currency from anyone. Why would they, right? If you're the issuer of the currency, then it should stand to reason that you never have to go get it from anybody else in order to be able to spend. So what's really happening when the government incurs a fiscal deficit, right? The government is spending more, let's say, pounds or dollars into the economy than it is subtracting back out, mostly through taxation. So the first point is that a government deficit is just the difference between two numbers, how much they add relative to how much they subtract. When the government's budget is in deficit, quote unquote, it means that they are making a financial contribution to some other part of the economy. Their deficit becomes a financial surplus in some other part of the economy. Now we get to the question of debt and borrowing. Where is that happening? What is that about? What happens is that the government matches up its deficit spending by issuing new bonds, gilts in the UK, treasuries in the US, JGBs in Japan, and so forth. So if we take very simple numbers to make the point, and suppose the government spends $100 into the economy, but it only taxes $90 back out. It has laid $10 in the system. We call them reserves, right? It has placed money in the system. But it is matching up the deficit spending by issuing bonds. So you can think of what's happening as the government is making a $10 deposit that it instantaneously transforms into a $10 government bond. So it's really spending the bonds into existence the same way that it can spend dollars into existence. It's not borrowing in the way that you and I would borrow, because when we borrow money, we walk into a bank, sit down with a loan officer, ask for a loan. We don't put the money on the table first and then ask the loan officer if we can borrow the money. When the government sells bonds, it is first putting the money in and then turning those dollars or pounds or yen into a different form of government instrument, into a different kind of money. So when you say people worry about how we're going to pay it back, I say, what is there to pay back? It's already the money. It's already a monetary instrument that we ought to think of as just part of the broader money supply.
So, I mean, what does that mean then in terms of the constraints that a government would have? It surely wouldn't be the case that the government can spend whatever it wants. It must, there must, if it's not necessary to monitor the difference between those two numbers, then it must be necessary to ensure that they don't overspend in some other way.
Yeah, I don't think there's much point in monitoring the difference between those two numbers. There is a point to monitoring different metrics in the economy, like inflationary pressures. That's the thing you want to look out for, right? So when you say, well, there surely must be some limit, the government can't just spend whatever it wants. Well, it can. Here's the limit. A currency issuing government can afford to purchase whatever is available and for sale in its own unique currency. So the US government can afford to buy whatever is available and for sale in US dollars, not just domestically, but internationally. Whatever the rest of the world is willing to produce and sell to get the dollar, the US government can command those real resources, can buy those goods and services. Now, that's a very different thing from saying that currency issuing governments should purchase everything that is available for sale, right? Those are very different statements. So MMT recognizes that the relevant constraint on government spending is inflation. It's not running out of money. It's not going broke. It's not turning into Greece. It's not the usual sort of things that we have been told. There is a limit, though. There is a constraint, and it's inflation. And, you know, Guy, I think where we are in the world today is that the macroeconomic profession has shifted its thinking in this direction. Almost no one today talks about Japan or the UK or the US or Australia as having the ability to run out of money, that, you know, this idea that you're going to have payments coming due that you can't afford to make. That those debates are largely in the rearview mirror. What we're debating here in the US and I think around the world is how much is too much, how much fiscal support runs the risk of pushing spending beyond that sort of safe limit. And so we're having a very different debate today, and it's centering around inflation risk.
I don't think many of the electorate would really feel that was the nature of the debate now. And I know you sort of introduced this as being a communications problem. I mean, is there almost a kind of subterfuge going on here that the economy is being managed in one way, but there's a reluctance to actually kind of communicate to people that this is now the new constraint?
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. There are different channels of communication, right? Among economists and policymakers, I think that the debate has definitely shifted to the inflation constraint. That's what we're all preoccupied with. But there are still, lawmakers who will get on television and, beat up the other side for running up the debt and putting future generations at risk and all of that sort of thing. So people definitely are still hearing, the sorts of, in the book, I just say myths, they're just the myths surrounding the deficit and the debt. And that's still part of, what the average person encounters when they hear these topics come up. But I think at a different and I guess higher level, scholars and economists and policymakers inside the White House, for example, they are very much focused on the inflation risk, not, what they think is affordable or concerns about deficits or anything like that.
Imagining we're at a different state phase of the economic cycle, imagining we're at a stage when the economy is overheating. I mean, do you have a sort of sense of what the policy prescription would be there? Would it be a sort of the idea that you need to take some money back out of the economy?
Probably not. It's so interesting because and this is where I'm getting super excited by the way that my profession is now starting to interrogate questions like this. Because, for most of my, well, nearly all of my professional career as an economist, the mainstream of the profession has been perfectly content to accept the idea that when inflationary pressures build, when you see headline inflation pick up, that there's only one correct policy response. All you need is for the central bank to dial rates higher, and that will dial inflation down. And it's sort of just an article of faith that the central bank has this powerful tool called the overnight interest rate. And all they have to do is nudge it up 25, 50 basis points here or there, and that somehow that will reverberate through the system. It will cool borrowing and spending, and headline inflation will come down. I have never, in my 25 plus years as an economist, I've never subscribed to that view. I think inflation is much more complex. I think that this idea that a one size fits all solution, you just jack up interest rates and inflation will come down, I have never believed that. I don't think there's evidence to support that. So when you say to me, what's the right response to dealing with inflationary pressures? I say to you, where are the inflationary pressures coming from? Because it is pretty unlikely that you're going to have this sort of what do I want to say? Inflationary pressures across all industries, across
Yeah.
all levels of wages, right?
Like
So
a
somehow,
parallel move in prices that.
yeah, you're going to have distortions in pockets, and it could be healthcare, it could be energy, it could be housing, but the likelihood that you're going to get generalized price increases across a whole range of, industries and goods and services, it's pretty unlikely. So when people ask me this inflation question, what do you do if inflation picks up? My first response is always, well, what's pushing inflation higher? We have these indices, these price indices that we build. We decide what goes in. We decide how to weight the different items in the consumer basket. And you can have headline inflation because one item in the basket suddenly becomes much more expensive, even if everything else is getting cheaper or not increasing in price. So it's like, if we finish talking here and I go down to my basement and I discover that my basement is flooded with water. Okay, I know I have a problem on my hands. Got a big mess, but I don't know what to do about it yet because I don't know if one of the kids left a faucet running. I don't know if the toilet's overflowed, the dishwasher's leaking, a pipe burst. I don't know. So to address the problem I'm facing, I have to know where the water is coming from. And that's how I think about inflation as well. Lumber prices. There was a great piece written by Joe Weisenthal, who I don't know if that's a name you
Yes.
folks. Yeah, but Joe did a great
From
little piece.
Bloomberg, yeah.
Yeah, from Bloomberg. He did a great little piece, I think, yesterday on lumber prices. And, you know, lumber prices are soaring. And Joe, I think quite rightly, wrote this little piece up saying the way to deal with lumber price inflation is to spend a ton of money on things that use lumber, because the inflationary problems come from supply shortages that came from you know, a lack of persistent demand for housing and other, you know, things that use building materials. And so lumber producers got caught short with inventories, but you got to build those back up and show that you're going to have stable demand going forward. So in other words, he's saying you need to spend a lot of money on the very thing that's expensive to bring the price of that thing down. And it sounds counterintuitive, but I think it's exactly the right way to think. You know, building out capacity helps to restrain inflationary pressures that come from the supply side.
I really thought you were going to go for more of a supply side angle there and talk about the, you know, I guess the possibility of more infrastructure investment and things like that that could address inflationary pockets, I suppose.
Well, I did. I mean, I buried it. I buried it at the very end, but I did say building out capacity, right, is a great way to deal with, if that's, again, if that's the binding constraint and the source of the inflationary pressures, then yes, it makes sense to build out supply capacity, productive capacity to alleviate some of the inflationary pressures. I wrote about it in a recent New York Times column, and I spent quite a lot of time talking about how to think through potential inflation risk as it's associated with some big infrastructure spending program and the different ways that you could mitigate inflationary pressures while the spending is being rolled out that don't involve either cutting back the program, right? If the point is to roll out a big, ambitious infrastructure spending package and you start to get inflationary pressures, I guess one way to react would be, well, spend less, carve out some of those dollars, don't spend them as quickly. But if you want to actually get the infrastructure in place, that's not what you want to do. You don't want to pull back on the spending. So you have to find other ways to alleviate inflationary pressure along the way. And I talk about a lot of things that could be done on the supply side to give you more capacity as you spend that money into the economy.
I think what gives a lot of people anxiety about this idea is that I think their distrust of elected politicians essentially, and I suppose the incentives that might drive them to spend poorly, to spend unwisely, and to effectively not manage that inflation in a way that's going to be best for the electorate. Is that something you worry about? Is it something that you think about that you like have a clear idea of what the solution to that would be or anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something I both think about and worry about. You have to earn trust with the populace. There's no question. And you know, if people remember, have concrete memories of, you know, boondoggles and, you know, government spending money in ways that were clearly you know, giveaways, there's a lot of grift, there's a lot of waste and so forth, then they are going to be reluctant to buy in to the, you know, proposal to spend trillions of dollars and do it efficiently and do it well. But you know, what I can say is that right now we have a president who has gone before the American people and said, I would like to spend, now we don't have the full package yet, we have phase one, but phase one is 2.25 trillion, and I think it's likely that the phase two that completes the infrastructure, right, both the physical and human, it's probably going to be about a $3 trillion pitch. And so he's gone to the American people and said, let me lay it all out for you. And in very concrete terms, right? How many bridges, how many people, you know, living in communities that don't have water that they can drink, how many electric charging stations, how, like, it's a very concrete thing. And what I can tell you is that the polls are overwhelming in this country in support of what he is advancing, from Democrats, independents, and Republicans. The numbers are off the charts. They're well above 50%. So in other words, people want. They've already bought in. They believe that this is a worthwhile use of public money. They know that infrastructure has been long neglected. They want to see the government move on this. And then your question is to, you know, whether they can roll this out in ways that, you know, you'll never avoid any and all possible, you know, criticisms with respect to who got money and how and that sort of thing. But, you know, this administration doesn't want to do it the way the Trump administration talked about doing infrastructure, which was largely to rely on private sector putting up money and a lot of user fees, you know, so that the burden fell very heavily on, you know, broad swaths of the American people. And the Biden administration is trying to do it differently and said, we want to spend a lot of money, but we're not going to ask you to pitch in a whole lot for it. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
So you mentioned, or you just talked a bit about the US. You listed off a few different countries that you described as currency issuing governments. Obviously, not within there. The Eurozone wasn't within there. I mean, is this a real problem for the Eurozone? Is there a way to it's not a single entity that, or it's not. Each of those countries is no longer now a currency issuing government. So is that a problem? Is it going to be a major economic constraint? Is there a way around it? What do you think?
Yeah, there's a way around it, and they've found it. They have found it. And, you know, I was writing about this before the euro was officially introduced. So back when I was a PhD student and I was writing my doctoral dissertation, I had a chapter on the euro. And I could see then, along with a pretty small handful of other economists, that this Maastricht Treaty, which was the blueprint for the introduction of the euro, had a design flaw in it. It's like, you know, you have a document with a birth defect, and a handful of economists were saying, hang on, fix this before you go forward, because if you don't fix this design flaw, you're going to end up in a situation where, and we laid it all out, you're going to have a debt crisis, you're going to have yields blowing out, you're going to have financial markets discover at some point that they are lending to currency using governments, no longer currency issuers. And when they put two and two together and price that default risk in, all bets are off. And so, you know, we laid this out years in advance of 2010, you know, when countries got, you know, enveloped in this debt crisis. But so look what happened. You know this history as well as anyone, right? Mario Draghi ended it with those three little words, whatever it takes. And that brought rates down, that contained the collateral damage, but only after so much hardship, misery, right? Self-inflicted pain. So then fast forward, you get to COVID. You have Christine Lagarde. She's there. The wheels start to come off the economies around the world because of COVID. Yields start moving higher in Europe, in some countries. And she says what? It is not the job of the ECB to manage spreads. And I went, wait, what? What? Are we going to do this again? Seriously? I mean, I heard her say that and I thought, you got to be kidding me. The ECB is the currency issuer. They are the issuer of the currency. So the currency issuer can backstop this project, and they have. And it only took about 48 hours for her to walk back those remarks. And then, of course, the ECB has been managing spreads, and you have the emergency pandemic purchasing program. And so what I will say is that for right now, for now, the ECB has effectively restored monetary sovereignty to countries in the Eurozone. The ECB said, spend, we have your back, run the deficits, handle the economy, handle the pandemic, spend the money, we got you, right? We will backstop you. We will not let yields blow out. So I don't know where the 10-year is on Italian government bonds today, but the last time I looked, it was about 80 basis points. 80 on a 10-year Italian government bond with debt to GDP headed for like 170%. And we're paying 1.6 here in the US, you know, on the 10-year. It doesn't make any sense, except that it does, because the ECB is making it so. So there's nothing to prevent the ECB from playing a role like this in perpetuity. They could do it. Now, the politics obviously are where the rubber meets the road. Will they? Or will they at some point withdraw fiscal support, tell countries, now you must get back in compliance with Stability and Growth Pact and Maastricht, right, 60% debt to GDP. If they do that, then all bets are off. Then it becomes, I think, very difficult to hold the whole project together.
Well, what a tantalizing note to finish on. Stephanie, that's been really, really useful. Thanks so much. I know we covered a huge amount of ground there in a very short space of time. So really useful. And thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found that as insightful as I have, and hopefully you'll join us again for a future edition of the Bruin podcast.